yourselves enough space to find each other, but also to give us an opportunity to understand deeper the subject that the committee members are ready to enroll in this piece of legislation before us. Thank you, honorable members. I'm going to take this opportunity and then watch Kosi and his team. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, members. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to respond. From our side, we really appreciate all the comments that have been received and the willingness of the stakeholders to engage with us. I think it's always a good thing to hear in all the different views, although we not always agree with all the views, but I think all of this helps and assists to flush out all the issues so that in the end that we make sure that we take the right decisions in the end. And once again, Chair, also thank you very much for the extra time. I think it was a very good decision to give everybody more time. And we continued after the process last year with our discussions to find common ground, and I must say that I think we have made some good progress as far as that is concerned. We could not agree with all the parties, but we have reached common ground with quite a number of the parties, as will later on come out and through the presentation. So the purpose has been to respond. This morning, Chair, we, in addition to this slide presentation, we also have a more comprehensive document that we will make available to the committee. We're still just fine-tuning some of it, but by tomorrow we will have the comprehensive document also ready for the committee. Just on the index, Chair, just quickly we want to touch on the context and then consultation process, and then the main part of the presentation will then be devoted to all the different issues that were raised by the parties. So that's more or less the flow of the presentation. As far as the context is concerned, Chair, I think it's important that we just very quickly touch on some of these issues and to emphasize also some of the benefits that if Parliament passes the bills and the Parliament passes it, that will be flowing from it. And a lot of commentary was then focused on negative issues, but one sometimes forget the positive issues that comes with the bills as well. And I don't want to dwell on all the things that we've made on our past presentations, but it's good to perhaps just recap some of them. That the bill now, you know, lays a very good and framework once again for customs laws. As you know, the current customs law comes from 1964. It's an old framework. It's very difficult to work with it today. It was written in an era where things were just done on a paper-based system and things were done completely different. We've also written it in a much more simpler form. I think some of the parties acknowledge here, especially the SAF people mentioned that it's a much more digestible in piece of legislation. People can, it's written in a more simple language for people to understand. We've checked it from a constitutional point of view, from an international agreement point of view. And then also, I think one of the big indicators of a good customs and a modern customs system is whether the policies and the procedures and processes are very clear. Because in a customs environment is very dependent on the processes that are being followed and the procedures that are being followed, etc. And that should be clear to all the role players. We've also checked it against the National Development Plan. And if we just benchmark it against some of these sort of headings that you also find in the National Development Plan, whether the goals make things much more transparent and predictable for people to do business in South Africa, we've listed a few examples there. Once again, from a procedural point of view now, the goals makes it very clear. It sets out the procedures for all the different kinds of customs procedures, whether it's a transshipment procedure or a transit procedure or a warehouse procedure, the bill chapter by chapter spells out exactly what the procedures are and makes it clear for the people who need to work with it. So, and from a predictability point of view, we've now included an advanced ruling regime that people can approach us for advanced ruling before transactions. We make provision, we can issue interpretation notes and guidelines. We have a more fixed penalty regime that will be applied or can be applied in a much more uniform way. There's a new tax code that we proposed. Those will also be, customs will now be subject to be ombud. So there's quite a number of issues in the bill that makes things much more predictable and gives much more certainty for business as far as the application of the laws are concerned. It also promotes exports, and we list a few examples there of how it promotes exports. I don't want to go into all of them. I maybe just quickly touch on the last one there. That was the last bullet on the to promote exports. That was a big issue, for example, for South Africans who trade into Africa or into other parts of the world. That if you have a warehouse in South Africa, currently you've got to store your dutiable goods and your non-dutiable goods and your goods that's in free circulation. You've got to keep it in separate warehouses. And that still comes from the old era of the 60s, that you can't mix these things. Now the bill will allow that you can keep these goods under one roof in one warehouse. It will make it much better for traders to optimize their storage capacities, and it will promote South Africa also as an export hub, and be it into Africa or into other parts of the world. From a business competitive point of view, we've listed some points there. We bring the law now in line also with the VAT legislation, for example. So that if you're a compliant trader and there's a refund due to you within 21 days, the refund is not made, then interest will start running. And these sort of rules you don't find in the current business. On the next page, we've done away with some issues with multiple clearances. For example, currently when goods are cleared for warehousing, you've got to submit two clearance documents. Now it is a single clearance document. In some instances, we will allow you to do incomplete clearances, and then you can follow it up with a supplementary one later on. We allow for extraordinary circumstances where you can depart from some of the rules. We have multiple cargo reports currently, and in future we will only have one loading report 24 hours before the goods are loaded in the foreign harbour. It must be reported to the South African Customs Authorities, and it's only if information changes through the value chain that you need to give us a supplementary cargo report. Otherwise, it's only one cargo report that needs to be submitted. From a small business point of view, we also try to create an environment. We mentioned it in our last presentation for small businesses to flourish. And we once again mention one example there where small businesses take part in processing activities. There's a possibility that they, for example, can be exempt from registration where they subcontract to certain other parties where the thresholds are below certain levels. So we try and cater for small businesses as well in the legislation change. These are all examples of how we try and facilitate trade, but as we've also said consistently, it's always a balance between facilitating trade and also the control over goods. And that's our other big responsibility, to make sure that illicit goods, undervalued goods, etc., doesn't come into the country. So, the main job of a customs authority is there to take control over goods once it sort of enters the Republic, until it either leaves the Republic or until it is cleared for home use. So to improve these controls, we're proposing provisions that will improve the supply chain. And one of the big mechanisms how the supply chain is managed is through registration and licensing, and we've softened up the provisions around that. Also around cargo reports, as far as export procedures are concerned, goods must be transported only by a licensed carrier now to avoid the possibilities of round shipping or the diversion of goods. So there's a number of things that we do to make the supply chain much more secure. Also, on the next page at the top, as far as licensed premises, and take for example a warehouse, proper records now needs to be kept for all goods moving into such a warehouse or a licensed premises, and everything that flows out of the of such a warehouse to monitor the whole supply chain. There's also a more stricter penalty regime, although we will come later on to the penalty issue. It was one of the issues that were raised more for the smaller administrative type of penalties, and Saab raised the point that the penalties are quite harsh, and we've made we propose some relaxation as far as that is concerned. But otherwise, it is a much stricter penalty regime, and this was something that was debated in Nedlag, and it was an agreement that was reached there. Labour was quite insistent that the penalty regime should be improved as far as the current penalty regime is concerned, to ensure that illegal goods and unwanted goods do not come to the country, because ultimately it leads to job losses in South Africa. So there are then examples of how we improve the penalty regime. So that's just to put things a little bit in context before we move into the specific issues. We've also just listed here all the consultation that we've had since the 5th of November last year. We've met a lot of parties again with the shipping lines. We met SAKU again, although later on we will illustrate we've met with them many times before the 5th of November. We tried to meet with, we met with Busa, we met with Saab quite a few times, we met with Transnet. So we used the time after the hearings last year really to try and see whether we can reach agreement and common ground with some of the parties. Alright, then to move into the specific issues, Chair. You will remember that I think the biggest issue that was raised, the whole issue around the inland terminals. And before I go into the more detail of this issue, Chair, I just want to make it very clear again, because there's a lot of misinformation or misunderstanding, it seems to us, as far as this is concerned, especially about what is our intent around this proposal. And as I said the last time, I want to make it very clear again that it is not SAR's intention to close these terminals. It's not our intention to stop every container at the port. It's not our intention to congest the ports or to discourage rail or to disrupt the seamless movement of legitimate trade. What we want to achieve, Chair, is to get better information so that we can do a better risk assessment before the goods land at the harbour or when it lands at the harbour, so that we can be more targeted as far as our interventions are concerned. As we said the last time, we only stop between 1-2% of all containers that are coming in. There's 4 million containers coming in through all our ports in South Africa. It's impossible for us to stop all these ports. We haven't got the manpower to search all these containers. So we've got to be smarter as far as our risk assessment is concerned. That's why we need better information to target the interventions much better. I think the other point that is also important for members to understand that we've launched our new customs system last year. I'm sure members would have read about it in the papers. And the new system is now an automated system. We've moved away from the old paper-based sort of system. Today, it's an automated system. It is a centralized system. Gone are the days where you will have customs officers who will sit with stamps and stamp at every office. You know, the goods has now arrived at Germiston. It must now go to Pop Other. You stand there, you allow it and go to Pop Other, and then from Pop Other it can go to it. All of that is gone. Everything is controlled now in an electronic way and from a centralized point of view. The only way that officers can now intervene, if there was a risk assessment through the risk assessment system, a container has been identified, and then a message will go out to that specific officer or officer and say that container number so and so must be stopped and intervene and check. So the whole way that we are doing in customs business today has changed than what it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Things move much faster now. When you submit your clearance documentation, it is turned around within seconds or a few minutes. It is checked against the risk engines, and you either then get the green signal, your stuff can move, or if there's a problem, yes, then it will be identified for intervention. Sorry. On this slide, then, I just want to touch on it again, but I don't want to dwell on it. The last time we said that currently the goods now move from the port to the inland terminal on the basis of a manifest, and we have discussed what are the disadvantages of the manifest. It does not give us enough information. It is information that is given by the shipping line. It's not information that is given by the importer. We don't know the tariff, we don't know the value, we don't know the origin. It's not the impetus. You can't hold the party who ultimately provided the information liable in South Africa. So these are all the disadvantages of a manifest. Why we cannot carry on allowing the goods to move on the basis of a manifest to the inland terminal. On the next slide, we then said we need better information, and therefore a clearance declaration gives you much better information. You will remember that we had the two options. The one was a proper clearance document. We also said that if you don't want to call it a clearance document, we can call it something else, as long as we get the correct information to do the risk assessment, and that the information is provided to us by the importer, somebody in South Africa that we can hold responsible as to the truth of the information that is ultimately declared, and that the information is submitted to us electronically. As far as the status of the inland terminals are concerned, I just once again also want to mention, Chair, that a lot of times the word inland port is used. There's no reference in the current law as far as the inland ports. You will remember that the presentations were made, I think, from some of the parties to say that it is now, and if the ship now sails to City Deep and it sort of docks there, and therefore it is an inland port. The current law does not cater for an inland port. The current law refers to a container terminal and a container depot. In the proposed legislation that's before you, Chair, it also just refers to a container terminal. We are not changing the terminology. We're not taking it away. That's why I'm saying we are, it's not our intention to close inland terminals. It's there in the current legislation. It will be there in the proposed legislation. Busa raised the issue time and time again, but where is the border? The border has been, and it will still be, the international boundaries of the Republic. The current act provides that when goods are imported, the liability for the customs duty arises when the goods are imported. And in terms of the current act, import means is when the good arrives in the control area of the harbor, of the first seaport. That's what the current law says. And the importer, together with the other parties, are liable for the customs duties. In terms of the new legislation, liability will also arise when the goods are entered into the Republic. And enter will mean when it enters the territorial waters of South Africa and when the ship docks at the first port of entry. And once again, as it is today, the importer will remain liable for the customs. So from a liability point of view, nothing changes between the current law and as far as the proposed law is concerned. Perhaps just to sum up, I think the points that have been made by the JTCI and GMLS and BUSA, that the obligation now to submit a customs clearance declaration will have some negative effects. I think what they are saying is traders will now have to change their contracts or so. The Incoterms. We'll get to the Incoterms later on and we'll explain what the Incoterms mean. The sellers will now be reluctant to sell the goods under the new terms. The importers will be affected. Carriers will no longer issue through bills of lading. There will be delays as far as goods are concerned at the ports. Jim, we disagree with these statements that have been made. And we have made it our business to make sure that from a legal point of view, we don't miss a point here. And the last time we submitted to you a legal opinion of Professor Eisenheim, he's an international trade law expert, he's also an advocate. But since then, we felt that we must make sure about these issues. And we solicited two further legal opinions on this matter. Another one from an advocate, Pamenter, he's a senior counsel, he practices in maritime law in Durban. And also from advocate Hubert, he's a senior counsel, he practices in customs and also trade issues, and he's been practicing for more than 30 years. He practices from the Johannesburg Bar. See, and I, we've made copies of all three legal opinions and we've distributed them. Because we want to make sure that we don't miss a point from a legal point of view. And Chair, if you read the legal opinions, I think these concerns seem to us, and the advocates as well, that they appear to stem from a sort of a fundamental misunderstanding of the terms cost insurance rate, the CIF. That's a term that's the most commonly used term, term that is being used in international transactions. When goods are sold by the foreign seller to the local buyer here on the basis of cost insurance and freight. The cost insurance and freight is paid by the seller on the other side. Now the Incoterms, this is an internationally set of standard contractual clauses that are used by traders in international transactions. There are 11 of these rules. Later on, we will ask Professor Eisenheim, Chair, if it's approved by you, if he could also perhaps have a very short presentation to explain to us some of these legal issues. And I think this fundamental misunderstanding around an financial contract on a CIF basis is that the risk passes from the seller to the buyer when the goods are loaded on the ship in the foreign port. And it is at that stage that the obligations of the seller end when the goods are loaded onto the ship and the seller has paid the insurance and the freight. And the fact that there is now clearance at the first port of entry, which happens after loading in South Africa, cannot change the obligations of the seller. The seller's obligations ended when the goods were placed on the ship in the foreign country. On the other side, equally on as far as the importer is concerned, his or her obligations remain the same. His obligations were because the seller's obligation ended when the goods were placed on the ship, and in the past the liability was on the importer to clear in South Africa, to pay the duties in South Africa, and in terms of the proposed legislation it will be the same. And nothing will change it, I think. One of the other points that were also made, but because there is clearance now, people will have to move from this CIF type of arrangement to a duty pay type of arrangement. And the legal opinions makes it very clear that, and we've checked with the shipping lines, they have said to us that there's a possibility is there that they will issue their true bills of lading. You will remember that last week with the hearing, the question was also specifically asked to SAF, whether they've checked with the shipping lines, whether they will still issue the true bills of lading, and they said that that is their understanding, also as far as their interactions with the shipping lines are concerned. So the true bills of lading will still be issued. Nothing will interrupt the seamless flow of the goods, and the seller's obligations will stay the same, the importer's obligations will stay the same. On the next slide, see, the one issue that was also highlighted in the process is the issue of groupage. And now groupage is where one container is used for goods to be consigned by more than one consignor to more than one consignee. In other words, a person who sits in South Africa wants to share a container when he imports goods. He hasn't got enough goods that he or she is importing to fully utilize a container, so he or she shares with other importers to fill up the container. Now, a problem that can arise here, say for example there are 10 people in South Africa who want to import and they all share the same container. The rule now is that all of them must give us a customs clearance document. And if one of them is non-compliant and does not give the customs clearance document, then there will be a problem. Then the container will be stopped and there will be an intervention as far as the non-compliant importer is concerned. But from all our interactions here, groupage containers comprises less than 1% of all the containers that are being imported into South Africa. So we've done, if you just look at the rough calculation, if there's about 4 million containers that are coming into South Africa, and if 1% of them are groupage containers and 50% of them are destined to inland terminals, then it means about 20,000 containers will be affected. But as we said earlier on, we only stop between 1 and 2% of containers. So if you take 1% of the 20,000, then it means about 200 air groupage containers might be stopped. That's one a day, and that should not be such a detrimental issue as far as trade is concerned. And I think the other point that needs to be made is that groupage containers should now take an active role also in ensuring that their customers understand and knows what the consequences are if they are not making proper clearance. Chair, as far as Saku is concerned, the points were also made that there was not adequate consultation with our Saku neighbors as far as the implications of this proposed policy change is concerned. As you can see there, we started to meet with Saku a long time ago. These bills have been coming a long time. We, after the hearings last year, we made it our mission to meet with them once again to double check, and we arranged a meeting with them on the 29th as well, where we once again specifically raised the issue of the inland terminals with them. Botswana could not make at this last meeting, but they were at the other meeting, the earlier meetings, and no objections were raised by our South Department. The other point that was made is that the new proposal will not be aligned to the WCO, that's the World Customs Organization Revised Kyoto Convention, that's the RKC. And the RKC is really a blueprint for a modern customs administration, and they've got certain annexes that they suggest that countries should accede to. They have a set of general annexes and then they have a set of specific annexes. And in our previous presentations we said that we've acceded to, South Africa has acceded to all the general annexes. That happened in 2004 already. As far as the specific annexes are concerned, we have not acceded to that. But there are very few countries in the world who have acceded to all the specific annexes. But in the spirit of facilitating trade, we've made sure that we've incorporated many of the provisions of the specific annexes. In some of our previous slides, I think we gave the percentage, the numbers to you, and what the percentages that we implemented, etc. Now, one of these specific annexes, Annexe E, deals with the customs transfer. And it requires that a national transfer declaration must be passed when goods are required to move from one customs office to another. And this, the recommended factor 7, further provides that customs should accept as a goods declaration for customs transfer any commercial or transfer document for consignment concern. But here comes the important word then. If it meets all the customs requirements. Now the problem is, as we said, that the manifest, which is currently a commercial document, does not meet all the customs requirements because it does not contain sufficient information. And therefore, SARS remains compliant as far as the specific annex is concerned. On the WCO, that's, as I said, the World Customs Organization Safe Framework of Standards, the point was also made that the Customs Control Bill is not aligned with this framework of standards. Now, this framework was developed to enhance the security and facilitation of inland trade in South Africa. You will remember when our current Minister of Finance, when he was still the Commissioner for SARS, he was for a few years, he was the chairperson of the WCO. And South Africa was also very instrumental in the development of the SAFE framework of standards, and we signaled our intention to meet these standards. Now the framework advocates submission of not only an advanced cargo declaration as claimed by GLNS, but it also requires that a customs clearance declaration must be submitted prior to loading of the goods on board of the vessel in the foreign country. Now the current bill proposes both these. The first one is an advanced cargo report that must be submitted to us 24 hours before the loading. And provision is now also made for an advanced customs clearance, as you said, 3 days in advance of the goods reaching the first port of entry in South Africa. Now, requiring a mandatory advanced customs clearance declaration for goods consigned to an inland terminal is therefore a move in the direction of the state framework of standards. We are actually a little bit more relaxed as far as that is concerned, because we only require our advanced customs clearance declaration 3 days, where the safe framework actually is required at a much earlier stage. I think the last international agreement that was mentioned that the CCD is not aligning with the world, the WTO, the World Trade Organization Bali Agreement, that was the one that was now finalized very recently, I think it was last month, in Bali. And specifically, the point was made that the JCCI was of the opinion that Article 9 is limited to the submission of a manifest, and that we cannot insist on a clearance document, customs clearance declaration. Now, once again, SARS took part in the negotiations of this Article 9. We were represented in Bali when the negotiations took place. And the final text of the article makes it very clear that it is all subject to the national regulations. In other words, whatever is agreed there, it is subject to your domestic law. And that was also the point, SARF also made the point last week when the specific question was raised in this regard, that it's all subject to your national regulations. We've in the meantime also checked with the USA and the EU parties. They were also instrumental in the development and the negotiation of this Article 9, and they confirmed that the article empowers the customs authorities to prescribe the regulatory requirements, including the submission of a customs goods declaration at first point of entry. So, as far as we are concerned, we are of the firm belief that South Africa is fully aligned here with Article 9 of the Bali Agreement. Benchmarking, Chair, we have checked, we sent a questionnaire to quite a number of countries to check from their side what sort of information they require before a ship arrives in their specific country. And there you can see the feedback that we got from the United States. They require an advanced customs information declaration, and it must specify the tariff headings. And later on you can see there that the import security filing originates from the realization of the customs border protection units in view that they cannot derive an optimal and most effective cargo risk assessment if their analysis is just based on manifest information. And we list there what sort of information they require to check. We also had feedback from Canada. Canada is now more or less following the same lines as the US. and we've also quoted there from what the CDSA has said. The United Kingdom, Chair, in the United Kingdom, once goods are also moving outside in an approved port into a sort of a public space, then they also require a transit procedure, and that document also requires the tariff and the value and the origin. Russia, we also checked with Russia. Similarly, they require a transit declaration. Also, they require that it must include the tariff and the value and the origin. So you can see that many countries are moving now in this direction, Chair, that before they allow the goods at the first port of entry, they need proper information to do a proper risk assessment. On the next two slides here, we have just listed once again the consultations that we've had, this is more specifically now only as far as the inland terminals are concerned. So you can see we've consulted widely with staff, we've had many, many interactions. With specific importers, with the shipping lines, with Transnet, with our staff and partners, etc. In the end, then, to sum up why we need in stricter control, and here again, I don't want to repeat what we've said in many of our previous presentations, but we've seen that SACTU, in their presentation, have also illustrated the negative effects of illicit goods that are moving into our country and the effects on our economy, the job losses that flow from that. Fedusa echoed these views, and you will see in the last slides or last year we've also demonstrated that from our interventions at City Deep it's quite clear that the percentage of non-compliance is 26% there in comparison to the national rate of 14%. So you can see the non-compliance that we picked up at City Deep is much higher than the rest of the country. But more importantly, Chair, I think, is what you don't know. In most of the goods, as it has been said today, travel by road, say from Durban down to City Deep. And we don't really know what happens while the goods are moving from Durban. So even if you ultimately find a container in City Deep, then all the illegal goods have been removed from the container on its way from Durban to City Deep. That's why you need better information to do a risk assessment right up front. So inspections at City Deep today won't give you perhaps all the non-compliance that there is. We've again listed some of the incorrect clearances there. You will remember we had it in quite a few lists of the non-compliance. I think, Chair, what is important to also mention, if you look at non-compliance internationally, it is said that, and not just for customs, but the tax gap then varies between 5% and 30% of the revenue that is collected. Now, if you just look at customs duties, our customs duties that we collect now annually sits at about between 35 million to, I think one of these days it will be 40 billion. Now if you take it at the lowest number, you say the tax gap for customs is 10%, then we're losing about 4 billion rand in customs every year. But customs not only collects in customs duties, we also collect the import VAT. If you add the import VAT, customs collects about 150 billion rand a year. If you say that the gap is 10%, then it sits around 15 billion that we're just losing in import customs duties and import VAT. Well, Chair, coming back to what is Mensah's revised proposal, you will remember we put two options on the table at the time. The one is a full customs clearance 3 days in advance. The other one was, we don't call it a clearance, but a separate kind of document that gives us the information. But our interactions with the external parties, specifically SARF, they eventually preferred that we go the route of option one. They've also mentioned that they are in agreement with our views last week when they were here. It will be better for them to go with the option of a full customs clearance declaration, because if it's just a form that they will have to provide, they in any case have to give us a clearance document at a later stage, so it will be a duplication if we go with the option two. So they have all the information, so they can just as well give us the customs clearance declaration up front. So in a nutshell, what the proposal then is, Chair, is that a customs clearance declaration for a permissible customs procedure must therefore be submitted for containerized goods, consigned to a licensed inland container terminal. The declaration must give us inter alia full details of the tariff, value, origin, and the importer. The declaration must be submitted at least 3 days before the arrival. And as I said, SARB confirmed to us that they can do this. They have that information at that time already. And the significance of the 3 days, Chair, is that Transnet needs 3 days advance notice to organize the rail stack so that they can then know this container is on its way. So by the time the container then lands in Durban, they've organized the rail stack so that the container can go on rail. That's the significance of the 3 days. Penalties, we've agreed that the penalties will only kick in if the declaration or the clearance is made 3 working days after the arrival of the goods at the first port. When the clearance document is submitted, customs will then provide a provisional release before the arrival of the goods, and that will then enable the parties to plan their supply chain. And the provisional release will be interpreted by SARB as an electronic message that will go out, and it will include information regarding the terminal or the depot to which the goods must now ultimately remove. We will then in the message say you can provisionally take these goods now to City Deep, for example. The provisional release will ultimately be followed up by a final release because anything can still happen in between. The first one cannot be a final release because the goods are still on the ship. It's impossible to be final release because, for example, say the ship sinks, and how can we give final release? You can only give final release once the goods are in South Africa. The revised proposal will now provide a lot more certainty and predictability for all the rail players, as you said, to supply or to plan their supply chain and the movement of the goods. What we've also said here, that if the bills are passed by Parliament, we will delay the implementation of this part of the bill for at least 12 months to give people proper time to plan, both from our side and from the trader side and all the road players. So we won't switch this part of the bill on immediately. And then here, what we also proposed in addition now, this was not mentioned last week, but we thought maybe we should put this also on the table. We propose that we put in a clause in the bill as a sort of a fallback position to address any unforeseen or unintended consequences or any anomalies that may arise as a result of the implementation of the bills. We had a similar clause when that was implemented in 1991, and it helps to give us some flexibility if something goes wrong, then we can use this clause to address those unintended consequences. Okay, so why the clearance at first port of entry will then mitigate the risk, Chair, is as we said that we now will have the information 3 days in advance, and it will enable us to run the necessary risk checks as far as the goods are concerned. And then we will basically have 3 categories of goods. We've sort of colored them in as in red and amber and green. If goods are ultimately identified as high-risk goods, because we've run the information that we got through the risk engines now, then those goods will be detained and they will be held at the first port of entry, where there will be a customs intervention ultimately. And we've said that this will be between 1 and 2% of goods, and that's the number of containers that we are making interventions in currently. Then you will have sort of a medium or low-risk containers. containers that might be identified. These containers will also be detained, but they will not be stopped and unpacked in Durban. They will still be allowed to move seamlessly in that terminal, and the inspections can happen there. And then you will have your compliant traders where there's no risk goods, and those no risk goods will just move seamlessly to the inland terminals. I think that's more or less than how it sums it up, how we will deal with the three different categories of goods. Then support for the revised proposal, Chair, and staff who are the representatives of traders and importers in South Africa, and they support the proposal. They've also mentioned that to the committee last week. The South African Association of Ship Operators, those are the people who issue the true bills of lading for these multimodal sort of to make these multimodal contracts work. They have indicated to us that it's possible for the shipping lines to issue the true bills of lading. That's also the understanding of SAR. There are these in touchy points that we, as I mentioned, of groupage and a few smaller items that we need to iron out, but as far as the principle is concerned, they indicated that it's possible. Transnet supports the proposal. Chair, we've handed out a letter from Transnet where they've said that they support the proposal. So in the end, Chair, I think the question that needs to be asked then is whether South Africa should continue to allow the goods to move from the first port of entry without proper information on the manifest, or whether we should implement the new revised proposals that we put forward. Then there were a few other issues, Chair, on penalties. Staff and raised some concern as far as certain administrative penalties are concerned, and asked that we should not impose penalties where there are bona fide administrative errors on their side. And they also asked us to have a relook at the quantum of those penalties and as far as the creditors' discretion are concerned. So our proposal, Chair, that we put on the table and that we've mentioned earlier on, is that we will put in a clause now that as far as clause 876 of the bill is concerned, which deals with administrative penalties where there's no real revenue prejudice, that we will have a letter out there that if it's a bona fide error on the part of the agent, that we will not levy any penalties as far as that is concerned. We will also reduce the penalties by 50%. And just for example, what is going into the bill are just the ranges of the penalties. The actual penalties will ultimately still be determined in terms of rules that we will publish. The benefits of the new penalty regime, Chair, is that it will provide greater consistency and uniformity of imposing the penalties because there will be less discretion. The non-compliance will specifically be defined, and then there will be a value that will be attached to either the breach or the non-compliance. So the officer will exactly know what is the amount of penalty that needs to be valued or needs to be imposed. And Chair, that those rules that provide these specific penalties within those ranges, we will draft those rules together with all the other rules you'll get it later on, and we will circulate it for comment before it is published ultimately, and we will have, if necessary, a workshop to explain it. And these rules, as we will ultimately see later on, will also be subject to parliamentary scrutiny. Then there were a few remaining issues. SAGA, Chair, that's the South African Organization for Oil and Gas, clearance document submitted can serve as the application document. Chair, both these in points we will accommodate. In fact, the one point is already accommodated in the bill. It was never our intention to perpetuate any manual processes or documents anymore. As we mentioned earlier on, the whole customs, the legislation and the system is now all based on electronic and automated processes. But as far as the declaration is concerned, whether that will be regarded as the application, that we will provide for in the rules. So we will accommodate the 2 points raised by SAICA. Then there were a number of points raised by SAICA. The one point, and it was not, this point was not only raised by SAICA, there were others who also raised this one, was the whole issue of sub-audit legislation. In other words, the rules that will sit below the customs bills. And because those rules are not available now for comment, the bills should not be passed at this stage. Now, Chair, the current process involves the passing of the primary legislation, setting up what the policies and the principles should be that should govern the customs control of goods and people. And we are comfortable, Chair, that the bills deal with those principles and policies, and in addition to that, we've even gone beyond that. We've also included a myriad of technical issues into the bill. If you just look at the two bills, the customs control bill has got 944 clauses and the duty bill has got 224 clauses. That gives you almost 1,200 clauses. The current Customs Act, which includes the excise part, which we're not even rerouting at this stage, has only got 120 clauses. So we've got 10 times the amount of clauses that we have in the current bill. Now granted, in the new style of the bill, we use much shorter clauses. We don't use these long sections anymore to try and make things much more easier to read and digestible. So that's one factor that contributed to more clauses. But we have actually moved many processes and procedures that we have previously found in the rules already into the bills. Because there's always this debate as far as subordinate legislation is concerned, that the administration should not usurp the powers of Parliament, and then that too many powers should be left in the hands of the administration to make subordinate legislation. So we try to err actually on the side of putting more issues in the main part of the bill. Some people actually criticize us that we actually put too many in clauses and too many issues in the main bills, and we should have rolled more into the rules. So this is always a debate, and to try and find a good balance here is difficult, but as I said, we rather than try to err on the side that Parliament makes the final rules as far as these policies and principles and even some of the high level rules are concerned. So it is not possible, Chair, really to do the final rules until the primary legislation has actually been finalized and Parliament has actually passed that. But from a constitutional point of view, Chair, the subordinate legislation, it must be accessible to the public, and the Constitution provides that it must be accessible to the public, and therefore we put in a specific clause in the main bill to say that these rules must be published for comment, and the submission of the rules must be subject to parliamentary scrutiny. And once again, Chair, as we said, with the penalty rules, all the other rules, we will arrange a workshop as far as that is concerned, and we will publish it for comment, and we will evaluate all those comments. So our proposal, Chair, is therefore not to delay the main bills until the rules have been finalized, but that we pass the main rules now so that we can get certainty to allow us to finalize the rules. There was an issue around registration, Chair, that was raised by SICA. The bonus guarantee sort of provides that a person who has been registered with customs, that the registration period will automatically lapse after a 3-year period. Their main concern was that if you've got people through a re-registration process every 3 years, it will be very time consuming for both parties and very disruptive. So we understand, sir, that this can be a very onerous proposal, and we have put an alternative proposal on the table as far as this one is concerned, that the automatic expiry of the registration will not happen in all instances. It will only happen in instances where a person has for 3 years been inactive. In other words, the person was registered, and now for 3 years we see this entity is dormant, there's nothing going on, the person is not importing or exporting anything. That is only in those circumstances that the automatic expiry will kick in. SICA also raised a point around the 2 years when it comes to the reassessment of duty. Remember, customs now basically works on a self-assessment system. When you import your goods, the importer or the agent on behalf of the importer actually does a self-assessment and pays the customs duties. But the customs authority currently has got the power to, within 2 years, make a reassessment. Now, the 2-year rule does not apply where there's been fraud or misrepresentation. We propose here that the 2-year rule be extended to 3 years, and the reason why we're proposing this here is to align it with all our other customers, or all our other taxes. Our income tax, VAT, etc. now, and works on a 3 and a 5-year rule. The 3-year rule is when the tax authority does the assessment, and the 5-year applies in a self-assessment scenario. So we should actually use a 5-year rule for customs as well, but we still think maybe we should just align it with the 3-year rule as we have with the other tax products. And the second point here is that this dispensation will now work both ways. It does not just apply for in favor of the tax authority to do a reassessment within 3 years. The opposite also applies. If a refund is due to the trader, currently we only make a refund within a 2-year period, but we will also make it now up to 3 years. So we will align it both ways. On the advanced rulings here, SICA makes 2 points as far as this is concerned. In the customs bill, we propose that there should be an advanced rulings regime now as well. Once again, we align it with the tax rules, where we also have an advanced ruling system. But they had 2 concerns. Advanced rulings are normally timed out. And their proposal is that we should do away with this default validity period of 3 years in the case of advanced rulings. We think here that we should keep it. That is how the advanced ruling system works for the other tax products. An advanced ruling can never be on a forever basis. The 3-year period is a general guideline. We can make it shorter or we can make it longer. So all advanced rulings that we currently issue in terms, like for example, for income tax, there is a validity period attached to it. It can never be an open-ended advanced ruling. And that's how it that's the international trend as well, sir. We also propose that we charge a fee for advanced rulings. Once again, we aligning it with the tax rules. For advanced rulings, we currently do in the tax environment, we charge a fee for that. And it keeps frivolous applications out of the system. And this is not a novel an idea to charge for these advanced rulings. When we introduced the system from a tax environment, we visited many of these countries. And Canada, they charge a fee. Many countries charge a fee as far as the advanced rulings are concerned. The advanced ruling is not the only way that you can get a ruling from the customs authority. It must be distinguished from your normal tariff and value determinations. That will carry on as it is today, Chair. People will still be entitled to their tariff and value and origin determinations where there is no fee attached to that. Chair, those are mainly the main issues that were raised during the hearings process, Chair. And once again, thank you for the opportunity to respond. And we will gladly take some questions, Chair.
Thank you very much, Kosti. Thomas, thank you also acknowledged. Can we take 5 minutes break?
Okay.
that
significant. The president of the Manifest, and then you hear there. Is this, I mean, there's been a lot of changes now in terms of more information, the clearance declaration, and what would the impact be of that clearance declaration? As a result of the inland courts would no longer be able to serve as a designated place to enter exits for government purposes. And this is the issue, of course, the status of the inland courts. And most of our amendments will speak to that to ensure that we still preserve the inland courts as a gateway to trade in Africa, and I think that would be very important. I would just like to know and have more information about youth arriving in the country. Could this not be done through stronger rules and regulations? Should it be in the Act? And you spelled out clearly how you will deal with the Act in terms of the rules and regulations. Are there not those thorny issues that might be high risk to impede trade? Could that not be rules and regulations that we could more easily address in terms of finding another option if trade is negatively impaired? We propose that the Customs Control Law should be amended to clearly define inland ports and recognize inland ports as the places to enter your exit, and that you will find in those documents that will be presented to you. Thank you, Chair. I think there is something else. If you could just give me a second, and I'll just pick up the notes. Yes, the issue of responsibility and also the legal aspect in terms of when responsibility shifts, where does it terminate? The responsibility of the shipping line terminates at the port of customs clearance, so the single journey from export to the final destination is no longer possible, I believe. Do you agree with that? Is it not correct? Because you said that the status quo in terms of the legal aspect stays the same. I'd just like to clarify that and have more information from you. But certainly in practical terms, this means that the importer has to arrange for national transport to get the goods to where he wants them. So longer the direct line, it's a change in terms of practicality, in terms of how the shipment should be, the transport should be done. And then the risk of supporting the bill, and you said that there's no risk, that does not appear to comply with the WTA agreement. We are still of the opinion that we should look into this. There could be a high risk, and the best solution would not be to pass this bill in the session, but refer it back to independent regulatory review. Would you agree on that, or is it not that serious that you think you've dealt with that question? Thank you. That is the one issue. I'd just like to make sure that I understand it correctly that at the port of entry, the text supports the view that the policy ships contemplated by SARS, namely that the goods may be moved under customs control and advanced from the first point of entry to an inland location, where then the goods will be subject to customs procedure. If you can just run through that again so that we can exactly understand the responsibilities in terms of the legal aspect and who is responsible for what part of the mission.
Thank you, Chairman. Many appreciate probably a long response that we got from some of the shows detail and shows that paying attention to detail. However, I think there's still a little bit of two or three things that are still not clear around the proposals that were made in the public hearing, primarily on the issue of 3 years and 2 years. However, I think that the Minister is saying 3 years, and we should maintain the 3 years. But nonetheless, Chair, I think it's important for us to see that the clearance declaration, if it's possible, unless it's confidential, just for oversight purposes, and just check what is this administrative burden and things that are needed for people to bring. Hence, there's that concern that this will delay other things as well. So I think it's very important, but not now, but it's important for us to know what is the actual requirement from the people there. Number two, I need to know what is the case injection for SARS on the exercise itself. But also to find out in money currency what is life. he took on stance for such an exercise and we will account it for your books. The issue of container terminal around the terminology of it, I'm just asking, the inland terminal is where to be mentioned to that way in terms of the term. Will the test anyway understand the same modification, this is what it is, but however there's a feeling strongly that it's coming out to say this is how we should term it. So I'm just concerned about it. Administrative burden, you mentioned about time consuming, you said that when has it started? Because last week people were complaining it takes you 3 days or 5 days, whatever, to get a response. Now you just said the saving in the system is all go, it's electronic. So I want to know when did it start and when did it happen. The revised version, the support for the revised proposal, there was the organization for accountants. I'm not sure whether it is Cycle or SAF, I'm not sure which one of it. They were quite outspoken, most of the things, so I just want to find out in terms of the revised proposal. Do they form part of, are they supporting the revised version? Because they kept on saying there was no need for this SAF, just one cash injection, quite negative in terms of the things were coming out. So I need to find out in terms of your grouping. Did you manage to get them on their side? That's the last question, sir. When you go for your page 41 on the registration to improve customs control, that's the last point where you speak about automatic expiry of a registration certificate if there's an inactivity taking place over the 3 years. Don't you think it's a bit unfair on the basis that we might not know what would be the issues of that business not being on operation within the years that you've listed? Will it not be enough for us to be able to get some information prior for us to nullify the certificate itself before you issue out the automatic expiry? That gives notification or get fact-finding mission as to what is the issue in rather than simulating because they're not in operation for the issue. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to SAF.
Chairperson, I just read the proposal and I do understand them from SAF, what SAF is requesting and what it is proposing. I do agree with them with some of the proposal. However, though, I think Chair, I still need some clarity to be convinced about very few things here. Firstly, I will agree that we retain the definition of the container terminal because indeed CPTP is not a port. That I don't have a problem. It can retain it as defined by the principal act. I don't have a problem with that. But I do have few problems with the following. If what you are saying through the chair, a provisional release will be given. I've got a problem with the release. If this is going to use to the release. Because now you are giving false hopes to the person that is receiving, to the buyer. What if you get non-compliance to the container? What if you get problems then he finds himself has to sit with that container for 3 months in the port because of they do not adhere to our policies, to our procedures. And by that time, you as such, you said provisional release. So I think we need to work on that. Just work on that wording. There's a problem with that. The provisional something. It has to be a provisional something. Because that provisional something only says to you, your container is on terminal so and so, it's on depot so and so. You just said, I'm saying, you're just giving information that indeed your container has been there. So if it has done it, if it is on our port, it's on our port. But we are acknowledging. That's the first thing. And then the manifesto information. That information which you depend on as such to do the risk assessment. The application or the format that has been used to collect that manifesto information, who designed it? Is it us? If it's us, the SAF, then I'll be okay. But if it's not us, we function of amending this bill is the facilitation and trade, but also the custom duties to the country. We need them. Those tariffs, we need them. So we can't do that. So you need to clarify them. So I need to clarify that change. And now, having said that, you look at the high risk, the media and everything. Because I think I've got a problem with it. You know, I'm sitting here saying, I'm having that picture when we went through the port. I think it was 2009 or 2010, I can't remember. And a condition. And you are saying that you will be able, definitely, guaranteeing 1 to 2% to ensure that there is risk assessment. How detrimental is that to our revenue? Eh? And I agree with you, because you know what? You might not have the capacity to do more or far better than a 2%. Even your very same scan machine might not give us proper findings. So I don't have a problem with the amendment of the bill, but so there are practical issues that I need to understand. That I need to understand that to change this, it's because at the end of the day, as the country will indeed make sure that the risk assessment is proper, the risk assessment, we are able to attain 80%, the collection of the customs duties, we are able to collect 80%, and the last thing, you have given us the studies from Canada and about the deterioration. I wonder how is China's one? Because they are our most clients. We would love to have them. Thank you, Chair.
I forgot that one.
Thank you, Chair. Chinese, the reasons and submissions are very apparent upon the attack. The introduction of these bills is not in any way going to impact adversely on the operation of our inland terminals, or maybe to say even most presenters' view is going to make sure that inland terminals are closed. It will be interesting, I mean, to know from us why this particular existence, what are they reading out of this submission that suggests that even if the reasons are so apparent, the inland terminals are going to be negatively affected. Why this insistence on this submission? What do you read about this submission? And out of interest, generation of non-compliance statistics was said to be at 26%. Can we be taken through, I mean, how is that, or maybe by whom? I mean, the network that are being employed, I mean, to generate these statistics. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just say this, I think SASA must be commended for the work they have done. After we had our first session last year and then the second session this year, it is just amazing, you know, how pleased I am where we stand with this completely new bill and this maybe this dawn of a new customs era in South Africa. So I must commend SASA for doing it. Great job here. And also, you know, for the first time ever, I've seen three senior counsel's opinion, you know, on an issue that made all the hot wind at our first session. You know, and I'm pleased that the lawyers are happy, but the maybe Busa and all the other participants should have involved more lawyers and less accountants in terms of the opposition to this piece of legislation. This one concern, we if we have this new custom era, would it take longer to get stuff through our ports? You know, that is vital. You know, we're running a current account deficit, and I don't want that to be added because we can't get this stuff
colleagues must come as well. To start with the first set of questions of Mr. Ross, around the declaration, where does declaration take place? Is it now at the terminal, etc.? And how will it change? I think, Chair, what is important, as I tried to indicate in my presentation right at the beginning, that we must understand that the whole way that we're doing customs today is different from how we've done it many, many years ago. We've already started the journey on this modernization. So even in terms of the current act, you will remember we have passed a sort of an interim section in the current Customs Act that actually allowed us to start doing many of the modernization issues and to allow us to roll out the customs modernization system that was actually launched last year. And in terms of the new customs modernization system as it was rolled out last year, as I said, we fundamentally changed from a type of an office-bound things where things are released by an office in terms of a stamp, etc. Today we have an integrated system. And goods are actually released from a central point of view. It's not so anymore that you arrive at the border with your bucky with all your goods and then the customs officer there makes the final call whether to allow you to come in or not. Now things work differently. That's why we want all these advanced cargo reports and advanced clearance declarations, etc. It all goes to a centralized system that runs all of it through a system. And at a centralized place, a decision is actually made, yes, we're going to accept this clearance or not. And then a message goes out to the customs officer, allow these goods to come in or allow it to be exported, etc. So the goods will not be cleared anymore at the terminal itself. We have an integrated system today. Nothing will happen. Yet the goods will physically move through the terminal and the inland terminal and depot. And we will have officers there who will inspect the goods, but they will get their instructions from an integrated system and from a centralized system to say that you inspect container number 1010. It's not for the customs officer anymore on the ground to make a final decision whether I'm going to inspect this container or that one. Yes, there will always be random cases where customs officers will make a call. For example, at the airports where you have dogs that will sniff containers generally, etc. But most of the inspections and the interventions that will happen will come from instructions from the integrated system and not a unilateral decision by the customs officer. There are many reasons why we've gone that route. That's internationally how it goes. It also helps with fraud, where you know that you don't have your own customs officials who make the final calls, you know, yes, I'm going to inspect this container, but if you pay me so much, I don't have to do it. The customs officer must now, if he gets that instruction, he must inspect that container specifically. So I hope that answers your first question, that it's an integrated system. That's how it's going to work. The fallback clause is a clause that we've put in to make provision for unintended consequences or in things that might happen. Say there is an absolute disaster as far as this proposal that we're putting on the table, and it is so that there will be absolute congestion, etc. Then the fallback clause will allow us to revert back to the current system, to the main system. But that will be an absolute last resort. A fallback clause like this is not really an ideal solution, and I think from Parliament's side, within the past, and from flexibility if when unforeseen consequences arise, and you can't wait for the next cycle of Parliament now to change the law, that in the meantime that it is possible, you know, to diffuse those huge problems and to resolve those huge problems. What we would propose that there should not be a permanent clause in the law, that we should perhaps put a sunset clause on it, that we allow it to be in the bill for say 3 years or 5 years, and that it should lapse after a specific period, so that you don't have this very powerful provision sitting there in the law that can allow an administration just to almost ignore what Parliament, you know, says in the main body of the Act. Yes, I think it is something that will give us that flexibility in the sort of first, say, 1 or 2 or 3 years of the bill to see what to find out the teething problems and so on. We, of course, hope that nothing will go wrong as far as this is concerned. There were questions around the manifest, the current position of the manifest, and the impact of clearance and the status of the inland ports. And as we said early on, the manifest is not a sufficient document for us to provide us with the necessary information to do the risk assessment. The manifest is not a document that is prepared by SAAM. It is a document that comes from the shipping line. They prepare the document. It's a commercial document that we use at the moment to allow the goods to move from the inland port to the from the harbour to the inland port. amendments around the ports. Chair, I don't think it is necessary, that as we try to explain in our submission, that we need to make any changes to the definitions. As we said, the current provisions don't refer to an inland port. And if you read the Customs Act today, there's no definition of an inland port. It's an inland terminal and an inland depot. And the new provisions will also just refer to an inland terminal, inland depot. There's no change in the terminology from the current Act to the new Act. So we really don't think any proposed changes as far as that will make any difference. There were questions around the responsibilities, around the seller and the shipping lines and so on. As I said, the responsibilities of the seller ends when the seller loads, when the goods are loaded onto the ship in the foreign harbor, and he paid the insurance and stuff. That's where the responsibilities of the seller stops. His risk is from that point onwards passed on to the buyer, to the importer now. He has paid his insurance and his freight, and then he is now released from it. So the seller won't have any responsibilities. Currently, the seller don't have any responsibilities in the country of arrival of the goods, to clear the goods here or to pay the customs duty. That's the liability and the responsibility of the importer. And in terms of the new proposal, it will be exactly the same. From the legal opinions, you will see that the main document or international agreement that is used is the CIF, Cost Insurance Freight Document. Once the seller has paid his insurance and freight on the other side, the risk has passed, and he will have no responsibilities here. The importer's responsibilities will remain the same. As I explained, in his liability currently is in South Africa. When the goods enter South Africa, it will be exactly so in terms of the new bill. The only thing that changes is that the goods will not move on a manifest anymore. It will now move on a clearance, customs clearance certificate. So instead of providing a manifest for the in-transit movement, we now require give it to us at a later stage, but then he will all unfortunately miss the rail cycle, and then there is a problem as far as that is concerned. The shipping lines, as I said, the shipping lines confirmed that they will still, it will still be possible to issue the through bills of lading. In other words, these multimodal contracts can still be entered into between the foreign seller and the South African buyer. The shipping line will, in terms of the cost insurance freight and the INCO rules, they will still take responsibility then for the shipping of the goods from the foreign harbor to South Africa. And when the goods land in South Africa, the shipping line then either contracts out to transmit to the motor goods to the international terminal, or if it moves by road, then there's another subcontractor that will move the goods to the inland port. But that all still forms part of a multimodal contract that can still be entered in terms of the new proposal. The WTO agreement, I think here we've explained that in our presentation, that you know, both South Africa, we were involved in a negotiation of that specific Article 9 of the Bali Agreement, and we've checked with our partners in the US and in the European Union on the interpretation of that clause, and that's why we insisted that that clause should be in there, or the words subject to national regulations. So whatever is in Article 9, it is always subject to your domestic laws. If your domestic law requires now not a manifest but a customs clearance, then it is fine because it is still subject to your national regulations and our domestic laws. And therefore, Chair, I think I do not think there is any doubt as far as this is concerned that we fall fairly and squarely within the WTO agreement. As I said, we've checked that. That's how the US interprets the agreement. That's how the EU interprets the agreement. I don't think there's any necessity for any further legal opinions as far as that is concerned. The port of entry sort of procedures, I think we have sort of set out what the procedures would be. We must get the clearance in advance, then we will have this provisional release, and it comes back to the other question of the provisional release. Unfortunately, it is important that we give people an indication at that stage whether the goods will be released or not. The reason, therefore, people need to know how to manage their supply chain in advance. They need to know in advance whether the container will be stopped, or whether they will have clearance that the container can move to the inland port, or that Transnet needs to know in advance so that they can plan the railing system and the rail track so that the goods can get onto the train in time. That's why you need the 3 days in advance, and then we need to send a message to all the parties so that they can start to plan their supply chain. But it is not a final release, and we will make it very clear that that's why we call it a provisional release. If something happens in between, if we receive new information, and we've made it very clear also to the parties, saying in the meantime, we got the clearance certificate and we've done our internal checks, but we get other third party information, for example, that there are dangerous goods in that specific container, customs must always have the right to intervene at the later stage and to withhold the final release. So that's why it's only a provisional release. But it will be in 99.9 of the cases of the provisional release will almost be the final release. But you never know whether there could be additional information that comes to your knowledge that might withhold final release. On the questions of the 2 years and the 3 years, want to align it with the other tax laws. But customs is a self-assessment system, and therefore the customs authority needs sufficient time to do its own checks ultimately and to do a reassessment ultimately. And that's why from a VAT side, from an income tax side, if it works on a self-assessment basis, then we actually have 5 years. But if it's on an assessment by the taxpayer, then it's a 3-year period. That's how it works for the other taxes. And we want to get greater alignment as far as that is concerned. And what we also mentioned, Chair, is that the arrangement is reciprocal. In other words, although SARS gets a longer period to do investigations, it also works for the benefit of the taxpayer. That currently we can only make refunds where we discover mistakes within a 2-year period. We also extend that to 3 years as well. So it works to the benefit of the taxpayer. So they also get an extra year now if you do discover that there is perhaps there is a wrong assessment and we need to give the taxpayer a refund as far as the issue is concerned. Yes, SAICA made quite a number of interventions around it. They said that we must not do this, this cannot go through, and that must not go through. I think I dealt with those issues. It was the issue of the 3 years and the 2 years around the reassessments. It was the issue around the advance rulings that they said it cannot go through, that the ruling must be timed down. As I explained, that's how it works in the tax environment. And what we're doing for customers, we're just extending the tax environment now to the customs environment. And that's exactly how the advanced ruling system works today for tax purposes. No ruling is on an open-ended basis forever. In every ruling that we give, we specify this ruling will apply for so many years, etc. And currently we charge for the rulings in the tax environment. I think the other point that they made was on the registration, and I think there they made a good point. The automatic expiry after 3 years, and we will revise that proposal, Chair, that it's only then if the entity or the trader was dormant for 3 years that we will automatically cancel the registration. Because no genuine bona fide trader really sits in for 3 years, imports nothing or exports nothing, then there must be movement on the account. I think those, more or less, Chair, I think deals with the issues around what SAICA made. On the cost, what it is going to cost for SARS, I think, Chair, these things have to a large extent already been factored into the customs modernization process that has been running for a few years now. I can't give you an exact number how much a customs clearance document and the implementation of that will cost you. I think it is, you can't really ring fence it and say it's going to cost so much. It's part of the whole integrated system. And it won't really cause such a lot of additional costs. Because there's a manifest document currently that must be submitted in any case. So it's just a different kind of document with better information. And the customs agents have told us they've got that information. Yes, the point of cash injections, and I think and the point that SAICA made here towards the end of the year, and SARS just wants to issue assessments to get more money in. Honestly, that's not the reason why we extend the 2 years to 3 years. We want to align it with our principles as far as the other taxes are concerned, and the refunds as well. So it both works both ways. I mean, why? We've got to give money away as well, as far as that is concerned. I think on the touch on the issue of the provisional release, and we take note of the point that you've made, that we must be very careful that it doesn't give false hope. I hope I tried to explain why we've got to give some indication, because people need information to plan the supply chain, but we will make sure that we don't cause sort of, you know, unintended expectations here, you know, amongst the parties. Franz will tell us, you know, what is in the manifest and what is in the declaration. I think there's also a clause in the customs control bill that says exactly what must be in the clearance document. You know, perhaps you must give us a reference of that clause, because the law actually specifies exactly what must be in the declaration.
Just this was in the presentation you gave you earlier. Just to refresh your memory, I'm just going to show you the difference between the manifest and what our current declaration looks. So you get a sense of what the difference is between the two. Now, there we go. Now it's very small, I'm afraid. But essentially, this is now the manifest, and it says, well, we loaded this in a particular port. It's going to Durban. And I'll read this. It's got one container said to contain 587 packages of furniture. Okay, so that's the information we have. And that's all we have. It also tells us how much the furniture weighs, which really doesn't help me very much. It helps the shipping line, but it doesn't help me. And it says it's going to go to Johannesburg. Now, what we're looking for is this kind of information, which is what is currently in our declaration. And you'll see it's not particularly onerous. It's the kind of thing that people are going to know, that they need to know anyway, a little bit later in the process. So who's the importer? Well, the importer should know who they are. You need to know what is the country of export, so where do these goods come from? Well, in this case, Hong Kong. You need to know where the country of delivery, that's us, South Africa. Then there's which one here, which is the country of origin. So where did these things come from? So it may have been transshipped to Hong Kong, but originally it came from Taiwan. Why do we need to know that? Rules of origin change what duties we need to pay. So if we don't have that, we can't apply our risk. Maybe this is a particularly low duty origin, and then the risk goes up a little bit. And we need to think about that. Maybe someone's giving us the wrong origin. Maybe there's an issue there. And then, very importantly, a description of what it is that is coming in. So in this particular case, we're now told these woven fabrics of synthetic filament yarn, including woven fabrics made from materials of heading 5404, other woven fabrics containing 85% or more by mass of textured polyester filaments. So now we have a detailed description of what it is that is coming in, and we know what the tariff is that applies to that. And also very importantly, the value. So the customer's value is $366,779. Great. So now we've got the information we need to evaluate the risk. And if it turns out that someone has been fibbing to us, it is signed by a local person or been approved by a local person, we can then go and ask them, excuse me, but why is this information wrong? So someone has taken responsibility for this information, and it's somebody who's in our jurisdiction as opposed to somebody somewhere else. So we're not asking for a huge amount of information here, but we're asking for key information that will allow us to risk profile what it is that is coming through our borders. I think that's really the gist of what it is we're trying to achieve with the changes.
Why did you do this? So now the risk assessment is based on the current situation.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes. So before up until now, what has happened is we have deemed the manifest to be such a declaration. But as you can see, it hasn't got nearly enough information for us to realistically control what is moving. And that is in clause 167 of the control.
try and create it as a concept, what you're saying is there's this very interesting change in the border of South Africa. You now have a border that comes up in from Durban, follows the national road all the way up to City Deep, and then the border closes down and comes round, and then you have this sort of outside of South Africa status for goods that are moving by road or by rail through South Africa. Now, I have to state that proposition for you to see what the problem is. Because if we treat these goods as not being in South Africa, how do you control them? And that's why you have an issue here. And I think it's very also very important to note that this is an issue that now only remains with a very small number of commentators. Okay, we've addressed the concerns that SARS had, and these are the people who are involved day to day with how this works. They're the people who are most directly impacted by it. And they have said, once we make the change to an advanced declaration 3 days before arrival, that they can do their planning and things can move ahead. There was a question, why do these people feel so very strongly about it? I can't speak for them. But the very strong sense we get, and the senior counsel we have consulted in, it's because they are misunderstanding the legal arrangements. Now, I must admit, I learned something when I first got involved with this. And as an accountant, I always think CIF meant the seller was responsible up until the point it got to me. But I discovered I was wrong. I mean, it's not what happens. The seller is just responsible for putting it on the ship, paying for the insurance, and paying for the freight. So if something goes wrong, well, okay, I can claim that the purchaser against the insurance company, that's great. But it's my problem. It's my and the insurance company's problem if something goes wrong. It's no longer the seller's. And that is a very important distinction. So I think people have sort of mixed up practical impacts with legal concepts, and that's why they have this attachment to the current system. And I mean, that's why we've gone to the trouble of getting all these legal opinions, because we keep on thinking, you know, they feel so strongly about this, maybe they've got a point. And so we go to the professor, and he tells us, no. We go to two other senior counsel, and they say, no, you haven't missed it. So at some point, I've got to say, well, maybe we haven't missed something. Sorry, I'm taking a bit longer than I should.
Any other thoughts?
I think there's just two more points that I need to deal with. I think then, just to close this point, there was the last point that was made on the that you were concerned from a practical point of view whether we will be able to handle the 1 or 2% of the inspections, you know, at the border around these high-risk goods. I think it all boils down then at the end of the day, Chair, that we need to be smarter and better then in identifying the containers that we need to inspect. That we can't waste our very scarce resources on inspecting containers that doesn't need to be inspected. And that's why we need such better information. And as I said the last time also, this proposal of getting the of the customs clearance document up front that gives us this information. This is not going to be the one silver bullet that will solve all our problems. It's one of the things in a much bigger picture that we need to do to make customs work better. We get information from different sources, and at the end of the day, all this information is fed into a risk index. Not just this information, then we get all sorts of other third-party information from other traders, from our. We've got international agreements with so many countries from whom we get information, and we exchange information with them. And all of that is fed into a risk engine, which then flags the interventions that needs to happen. Yeah, I think the last point that was made by Mr. Koornhof is will it take longer in the end, everything? I think think from our side that we've said for a long time now, as far as legitimate trade is concerned, we want to make things better, we want to make things faster, we want to make things more predictable for the traders, that things can move much faster. That's why we've rolled out in the new customs system last year. There's still a lot of further modernization that needs to be done to the system, but we've been working on that customs system for the last 5 years, and it's been rolled out in parts, and one of the biggest parts were rolled out, I think it was in September last year. And I think, Chair, one can say that SARS, from a customs point of view, is now really, from a systems point of view, quite at the forefront as far as from an international point of view is concerned. We have found that there's a lot of interest in our new custom system. We have had quite a few parties in countries from Asian countries who have come here and want to come and look at our system. We've had European countries who have come here to look at our system. We've had African countries who have come here to look at our new custom system. And the bills is going to be the foundation. It is the foundation on which this new custom system is built. So, Jay, just to answer, we want to make things work much faster and much quicker, but that's for legitimate trade. And if you're not a legitimate trader, just then we will guarantee you we're going to stop your goods and we will make things slower. Thank you, Chair. Oh, yeah. Chair, the professor has got one point that he would like to respond on, if possible.
Well, I'm on his way to here.
Thank you, Chair. I just wish to address one point, and it is about this fear that the inland terminals will be closed as a result of the changes. Now, the information that is asked in, to be given in the declaration now, that is information that is available from almost the date that the contract is concluded, even before the goods are shipped. So that's not very onerous in that regard. But there's a linkage that is made in the arguments raised about the closure of the inland terminal between the contract of carriage and the point of customs clearance. The information that we've got from the carriers is that it makes absolutely no difference to them. They will issue multimodal carriage contracts irrespective of where the customs clearance takes place. So in the contract of sale, the buyer will tell the seller, I need the goods transported say from Hamburg to Polokwane, and I need a multimodal transport document for that. And the sale is CIF, should be CIP, but that doesn't really matter. And the fact is that the carriers will issue that waiver for that transport, despite the fact that customs clearance takes place either a German or a citizen, it doesn't really matter. And that linkage that is made there between the point of customs declaration and the contract of carriage is incorrect. There is no real linkage there. The carriers are aware of the fact that goods have to be cleared and that involves certain arrangements that need to be made. And I think it should have been become clearer by now that if you can pre-clear, it makes the job a lot easier. And the fact that 60% of trade is already reserved and taking place by way of pre-clearance just makes that point. Nothing new is working. It hasn't impacted on the work of CTT up to now. And there's no reason in law why this change should affect a change as far as that is concerned.
Thank you.
So there's two last points just to prove that we listen to these questions very carefully. There are two that still need to be touched on. The question was, have we looked at China as a benchmark? We have contacted them, but they have not responded as yet. So we did try and get the check 100 containers, 26 have got a problem. I think that's the point that we're trying to say. Really. The expiry in 3 years, I think Quentin did touch on that, but the point there is, if someone hasn't done any business whatsoever with customs for 3 years, I mean, 3 years is a long time. I mean, in law, if you haven't asked someone to pay you for 3 years, that person can tell you to get lost if you come and ask them for the money on 3 years in one day. So it's commercially accepted as a reasonable period for what you call things to die, to avoid the law to prescribe. So we're saying if you have not done business with customers for 3 years, the chances are very, very good that you have stopped doing business altogether. Because there are not too many businesses that are going to do import exports continuously for a period and then just stop. I mean, it doesn't make sense. You are going to continue doing business or you are going to stop at some point. And of course, if your company goes out of business, one of the last things you think about doing is writing to everyone to say, hi, I've gone out of business. I mean, you tend to want to close that chapter of your life and move on. And so people who go out of business, stop doing a particular kind of business, tend not to notify everyone else of what's happened. And so it's just a practical measure to try and clear out people who are no longer active. We could try that. I just foresee one difficulty, which is actually getting hold of them. Because if you haven't spoken to us for 3 years, the odds that your contact details are still accurate are going to be very low. It's a practical problem. We can certainly look at that.
We can certainly look at sending a message out just before the 3 years have passed.
Point of customs clearance could be done either in the terminal or city peak, so it gives you two options. But the tie in with that option, or is it just a, am I wrong in making that assumption?
Just to give clarity on the last point perhaps first, as I said, now customs now works on an integrated basis. Clearance will be done centrally. The customs clearance document will come in. It's an integrated system. We're not office bound anymore, that this document goes to that office and this one goes to that office. It's an integrated approach. On the discretionary, I'm not sure whether I understand you completely, but the proposal that we made is that it's sort of fallback position that we propose that we put into the legislation, so that if there are any unintended consequences around the implementation of the law, then it gives us that amount of flexibility to change things or perhaps fall back to the current position, etc. We've actually engrafted the fallback position clause, and we can make that available to you as well. So you can see that it will, for example, say to address any unforeseen or any unintended consequences or any anomaly or incongruity that may arise from the implementation or enforcement of the provision of the Act. You may suspend or modify or provide for a departure from a provision referred to, etc. It must be aimed at substantially reinstating the legal position under the 1964 Act if that Act regulated the matter for the effective date. It may not have the effect of reducing or increasing a person's liability for import or export or entitlement to the refund. So it may not have any monetary consequences, but it allows you to fall back more or less on the 1964. So as I say, take the extreme example. We into the system, we see this proposal around the inland terminals, the chains doesn't work at all. It will allow us to revert back to the current system as we have.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for accommodating all the questions. Just with regard to the possible discretionary provisions, we also have to say in the claim section 18 of the Customs and Excise Act, and we have a document that we can present to you, and perhaps you can look at it and we can discuss it tomorrow again. Just to offer you an opinion, we're also trying to be helpful, and it's just one of the document, can you perhaps document. I'm not saying it will be, but it's in line with the Blue Sub proposal, and I'm sure you've had a look at it, and perhaps you can tell us tomorrow whether you think it could be accommodated or not. We'll appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Tomorrow is the committee. Today they are making a report. So tomorrow's committee deliberation will be in the
I understand, Chair. You know, I would not like to belabor this. You know, I wouldn't like to belabor this meeting, and then I will have to ask the son just to give those documents to Mr. Lander.
The document is the same as the documents.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I got it. Fine. Are you done?
Yes, done.
You have been successful to do it before you.
No, it's actually longer. In that matter, alone, 3 years.
Yeah. Now, honourable members, I think we should thank the team from SAS for really going an extra mile in their interactions with the stakeholders and ourselves. As the honourable Gordon also said, from the time we started interacting with this process, particularly last year, toward the end of last year, and now there's more clarity to the issues that were raised. In fact, at some point, even myself, I'm doubtful whether you've applied your mind on this piece of legislation before us. As I've already indicated, tomorrow the committee will meet and have its own deliberations with the intention to come to finality with the letters that you have submitted to the committee from Parliament. So on that score, on that note, I want to thank you very much. And I think we'll be also very assistive in making sure that you do your work the way you normally do it. In fact, my little experience in the 5 years that I've worked in this committee, that every piece of legislation that comes from SAS, anything that has to do with customs or tax, as a continue, we think this thing is not practical. In fact, even in terms of the e-filing of therefore personal income tax, when it was introduced, we were saying, you know, I think we think you're going to have to, you're going to create problems for SMEs, you're going to create problems for individuals, but today as we speak, you can go to any bus office and Toro, Jovi, anywhere, David. The queues that we used to see are no more than that. They've disappeared, less complaints. Of course, there'll be challenges every day, but I think SARS are beginning to lead in perfecting logistics in terms of IT systems. Your interventions in SARS, I mean, in the Department of Home Affairs, has gone a long way in assisting that department up to today. So I think we don't have any doubts that if this bill comes into an act, you'll live up to the challenges in terms of making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place to facilitate trade, because it is all about building the economy and creating jobs in the final analysis. And thank you very much for your effort and time that you spend with the committee. Honourable members will remain for about a minute or so just to do one business. You are released.
Thank you very much, and I think indeed it was a very good process, and your committee helped us.